It's important. Did the ship make it through? Since the first time she'd seen it, the first time anyone had seen it, the boundary of the ring space had been a dark and featureless sphere, like a black bubble seen from inside. Now, there was a twisting rainbow of energy or matter on it, like an oil slick on water. The darkness of it had always let Elvie imagine it to be infinite before. A vast and starless sky. Now, it felt close and finite. It made everything seem more fragile. A wave of nausea passed across the edge of her awareness like it belonged to some other body. No, Governor Song said. They were too close to the gate to shift back when the blast came. The energy through Tacoma Gate would have... They didn't make the transit. Please confirm, Medina. You're saying the plane of Jordan went Dutchman? Yes, we lost them. Thank you, Medina. Please advise traffic control that all transits are suspended until further orders. No one comes into this space and no one goes out. Not until I say so. To her left, Faez was at Jen's station, seeing, she assumed, all the same things. Feeling some version of the awe and terror and wonder that she felt. Understood, Governor Song said. I'll see to it. Thank you, Jeun, Segale said. We have some work to do. We'll need reports from the other systems. I'm guessing that there's been some damage from the far sides of the gates, too. It may take some time to... Gates moved, Faez said, in the same tone he used for trivial information. Laundry's dry. Dinner's ready. Gates moved. What? Segale said. Yeah, Faez said. Not much, but a little. And all of them. Look for yourself. Segale shifted the main screen. The slow zone bloomed, and with it corrections on each of the gates. The ships were all in place, all matching their expected vectors and positions. But a little yellow error code hung at the gates to show where they were expected to be and where they were instead. Segale's face was ashen. Elvie felt herself wondering how many more shocks the man could take, or, for that matter, how many she could. Yeah, so, Faez said, pretty sure I see what's going on. They just reordered, because there's not as many of them now. Equal distance between them got a little bigger. Tacoma Gate's gone. And, oh yeah, look at that. Tanjavur Gate was pretty much straight across from it. And it's gone, too. We just lost two gates, Admiral. And one of them had an entire world filled with people behind it. Chapter 20. Teresa. The science exposition was held in one of the public halls and on the grounds outside it. The vaulted ceiling gave the hall a sense of something that had been grown more than built, and the acoustic controls kept what could have been an overwhelming din of voices and noise calm and reassuring. 1,000 children from 5 years old to 16 ran and talked and made groups, associating for the most part with people they already knew and who attended the same schools they'd come from. The open schools all had their own stations in the hall, each one showing what the students had been studying in the last year and how it would add to the overall work of the Empire. Some, like the water cycle demonstration, were basic, meant for the youngest children. Others, like the Forest of Life that compared the different ecosystems of the New Worlds and the Programmable Matter Station that showcased the most recent materials science from Baragaun, were sophisticated enough to be interesting for her. And Connor was there. As the days passed, she found the sting of remembering Connor and Muriel being involved with each other grew a little less raw for her. Not painless. The image of them kissing, which she had very clearly in her mind, for something she'd never actually seen, still bothered her. So when Connor nodded to her when she walked by and tried a little smile, she didn't know what to make of it. Did he still like her? Was he trying to tell her that his connection with Muriel had been a mistake, or that he was glad that he and Teresa were still friends? She wasn't sure which option she was hoping for, or if she was hoping for any of them. Connor was confusing. Muriel and the others from her school had a booth about soil science and how to design microbes that could pass nutrients between organisms of different biomes, and Teresa was technically supposed to be with them. She didn't want to be there, and really she could go wherever she wanted. It wasn't like someone was going to tell her she couldn't. Instead, she went to the puzzle station, where younger children worked with blocks trying to recreate shapes or argued over how to fit circles into a square or build a complex structure with only gravity and friction to hold it together. She'd done all the puzzles 1,000 times over when she was younger. She moved through, giving encouragement and hints to the frustrated, and wondered if Connor would follow her there. A young girl, maybe 6 years old, sat at one of the tables by herself, scowling. Teresa sat across from her, because she could see the place where Connor would be from there. The girl looked up at Teresa and seemed to gather herself. When she spoke, it was with the stilted formality of someone who had been coached in what to say and how to say it. "Hello, my name is Elsa Singh. I'm pleased to meet you."
"I'm Teresa Duarte," Teresa said.
"Are you a teacher?"
Elsa asked.
"No, I live here."
"No one will play with me," Elsa said, scowling at her.
"I could teach you something if you want."
"All right," Elsa said,
and seemed to settle deeper into her little wooden chair.
Teresa glanced over toward the school display. Muriel and Connor were talking, but Muriel was doing most of it, her lips moving fast like she was fighting to keep his attention. To her surprise, she felt a little pang of sympathy for the girl. If Connor had convinced Muriel to alienate Teresa Duarte, daughter of the High Consul and maybe someday ruler of the Laconian Empire, and then gone cold on her, that would be a shitty thing to do. Effective, too, because the pang passed as quickly as it had come. Muriel could deal with her mistakes on her own.
"All right, Elsa," she said, refocusing. She pulled up her handheld. "This is called the Prisoner's Dilemma. Look at this." Teresa built a table like the one Illich had built with her. Explained the rules. Each player would decide to cooperate or defect, and they'd each be better off if they defected, but it would be better in the long term to cooperate. Elsa seemed only mildly interested, but willing to follow along. Connor started moving away from his group just as a new bunch of presenters arrived, washing through the hall with delight and gabbling. He seemed to disappear behind the flood, but she caught a glimpse of his brown hair. She thought he was coming toward her. Her heart started beating a little faster. She wasn't sure she was more worried that he would find her, or that he wouldn't. She played the game with the little girl, pretending to care about it more deeply than the stream of humanity over Elsa's shoulder. They both cooperated for a few rounds, and then, when Teresa felt like it was time for the rest of the tit-for-tat lesson, she defected. Elsa looked at the handheld with the results as if it didn't make sense.
"Now," Teresa said, "the thing is, once someone defects like that, you have to decide what..." "You cheated!" The little girl's voice was more than just loud. It was a shriek of rage. Her face was twisted in a vicious scowl and dark with blood just under the skin. "You said we should be nice!"
"No," Teresa said. "It's part of the lesson."
"Fuck your fucking lesson," Elsa said.
Out of a child that young, the profanity was like a slap.
Elsa grabbed the handheld and threw it into the crowd. Standing up so fast, her chair toppled, clattering on the ground.
Before Teresa could do anything, Elsa collapsed and started weeping on the floor. Security personnel were already moving through the crowd toward them, but Teresa waved them off. She felt trapped between wanting to comfort Elsa
or get her hand held back, or leave in humiliation and shame. Elsa's mouth was square and gaping as her sobs turned into screams again. Someone nearby shouted, "Monster!" And Teresa thought for a second they meant her. Then the woman was there. Older, with eyes the same shape as Elsa's, the same skin tone. Elsa's mother scooped the girl up in her arms, rocking her. "It's okay, monster," the mother said and hushed her gently. "It's all right. Mama's here. I'm right here. It's okay." Elsa clamped her hands over her ears, closed her eyes, and buried her head in her mother's embrace. The mother rocked her, gently making cooing sounds to soothe her. Teresa took a step forward. "I'm so sorry," the mother said. "Elsa gets overstimulated. It won't happen again." "No," Teresa said. "It was my fault. She's fine. It was me. I didn't explain the game well enough." The mother smiled and turned her attention back to Elsa. Teresa waited for the mother to start asking questions of the little girl. "What just happened? And what mistake did you make? And what would you do differently next time?" All the things her father would have asked her to make the moment meaningful. But Elsa's mother did none of that. She only calmed her daughter and told her that everything would be all right, that she was loved. Teresa watched with a sensation she couldn't quite recognize. She didn't notice Colonel Illich coming up to her until he touched her shoulder. "I'm sorry to interrupt," he said. "Your father is asking to see you. Now, if you can." "Of course," she said, and followed, only pausing to retrieve her handheld. Her father's private office was small. A small desk with a monitor built into the surface that could display flat on the surface or volumetrically over it. As she came in, it was showing a schematic of the slow zone, the gates, the alien station at their center, Medina Station, and a few dozen ships scattered through 750 trillion cubic kilometers, a space smaller than the interior of a star. Her father was still as stone, looking at it. It was like he didn't need to breathe anymore. "Is everything okay?" she asked. "What do you remember about the experiment in Tacoma system?" Teresa sat on the little couch, folding her legs up under her. She tried to recall everything she could of the science briefing she'd been in, but all she could think of was the crying little girl and her mother. "It's where we were doing the first tit-for-tat experiment," she finally said, "to see if the enemy can be negotiated with." It seemed ominous that she'd just been reviewing the prisoner's dilemma, and that it had gone badly. "To see if we can make it change its behavior." "Yes," her father said, then gave a small, rueful chuckle. "There's good news and bad there." He gestured at his monitor, throwing a report to her handheld. "Look this over. Tell me what you make of it." Teresa opened the report like it was a test from Colonel Illich. Her father watched her while she read through it, looked at the data sets, tried to make it all make sense. She tried not to read Admiral Segale's summary at the end, because that felt like cheating. She should be able to draw the conclusions herself. Then she reached a part of the report that she had to read three times to be sure she'd understood. She felt the blood draining from her face. It collapsed into a black hole? They collapsed the neutron star into a black hole? "We believe so," her father said. "It was precariously balanced, and apparently maintained at that balance point in a way we don't understand. When more mass was added to the star, it was enough to push it over." He put a hand over the report and looked into her eyes. "Dr. Okoye and her team saw that there was a danger from that. Do you know what it was?" "The gamma burst," Teresa said. "It's the most energetic event that there is. We've seen gamma bursts from other galaxies." "That's correct," he said. But she couldn't get her mind around it. "And what do you remember about Tacoma system?"
She drew a blank. She should have known. Should have remembered.
The star's rotation put the poles in line with the gate, he said gently. No other system we've ever seen has been like that.
What happened? Teresa asked. He took his hand away, letting her read the rest of the report.
We lost two gates?
We did, her father said, as if it were a normal thing. And we saw plumes of gamma radiation coming out on the solar system's side of every other ring gate, much the way they did when the Tempest hit the alien station in the ring hub with its magnetic field generator. And it was like hearing that sometimes you woke up in the morning and didn't have a color anymore, that red could die, or that three could be shot off the number line. Learning that a gate could be destroyed was like learning that a rule of her universe, so basic that she'd never even thought of it as a rule, had been violated. If he'd said, "You actually have two bodies," or "Sometimes you can walk through walls," or "You can also breathe rock," it wouldn't have felt stranger, more displacing. He raised his eyebrows.
What else?
She looked at the report. She felt like she was shaking, but her hands looked steady. It only took her a few seconds. And the plane of Jordan failed its transit, she said. We lost a ship.
Yes, he said. That, it turns out, is the critical issue.
Here is the decision we have to make. What do we do about it? Teresa shook her head, not disagreeing, but reaching for some kind of clarity. The scale of the damage was overwhelming. Her father leaned back in his chair, steepling his fingers.
This is a policy decision.
And policy decisions are difficult, he said, because there may not be a right answer. Put yourself in my place. Think about the larger picture. Not just now, not just here, but everywhere that humanity is going to spread, and forever. What is the wise course of action for me now?
I don't know, she said, and her voice sounded small, even to her.
He nodded. That's fair. Let me narrow the options. The rules of game theory are that when a ship fails to transit, we punish our opponents. That's the basis of the policy I put in place. So in light of what happened, do we follow that now, or do we stop?
We stop, Teresa said without hesitation.
She saw the disappointment in her father's eyes, but she didn't understand it. It was the obvious answer. He took a deep breath and tapped his fingers against his lips for a moment before he said anything. Let me give you some context. There was an incident when you were young, he said. This was when your mother was still with us, so you were very young, barely able to speak. You had a favorite toy, a carved wooden horse.
I don't remember it.
That's all right. There was a day when you needed to nap. You were very, very tired and very cranky. Your mother was trying to feed you the way she did before you slept, but you were chewing on your horse. Your mouth was full. So your mother took the horse away and you threw a tantrum. In that case, we had two options. We could keep the toy away from you so that you could do what needed to be done, or we could hand it back and teach you that throwing tantrums worked. The image of Elsa in her mother's arms came to her like it was being projected on her brain. Had all that been a mistake? Had Elsa's mother, by comforting her child, told her that it was okay to shout and flip over tables? It hadn't seemed like that at the time.
You think we should... You're sending through a bomb ship?
Tit for tat, he said. It means keeping traffic out of the ring space for a time. It means not evacuating any more ships until we can make the experiment. But we can show the enemy that we are disciplined. Or we can show it that we aren't.
Oh, Teresa said. She didn't know what else there was to say.
Her father tilted his head. His voice was still gentle, almost coaxing.
This is why I want you with me.
These are the decisions people like you and I have to make. Normal people don't. This is the logic and the vision we have to apply. And we have to be ruthless about it. The stakes are too high for anything else.
It's the only way we can win, she said.
I don't know that we'll win, he said. I've never known that. I've always known that we'd fight. From the moment the gates opened, I knew we'd go through them. That and the chances were good that we would encounter whatever had killed the civilization that came before us.
Goths, she said. Goths and lead-lined water pipes.
He chuckled. Illich has been talking about ancient Rome again. Yes, well, we can call them Goths if you like. As soon as we knew that there was something out there, we knew that we would come in conflict with it. The war was inevitable from the second we had an opponent. I don't know whether we'll defeat them, but I know that if we defeat them, it will be like this. With intelligence and ruthlessness and an unwavering purpose. Those are the only tools we have that matter.
Teresa nodded. I'm sorry, she said. I had the wrong answer.
I knew you might, he said. It's why I asked you here. You will learn over time how to think the way I think, how to be the kind of leader that I've taught myself to be. Some of it will take effort. Some of it will happen naturally, just because you get older. And some of it, I think, will happen as you change.
Change?
Transform. Become immortal. I've spoken to Dr. Cortázar about beginning the process with you. It will take time, of course, but since I began the treatments, I've learned so much. Things I couldn't know when I was just human, I suppose.
He took her hand. The opalescence in his eyes and skin seemed to brighten for a moment. When he spoke, there was a depth to his voice, like the room had gained an echo.
There's so much that I see now that I never saw before. You'll see it too.
Chapter 21. Elvie.
Elvie could see Segale steeling himself for her reaction. It was in the way he tightened his jaw and the flatness of his eyes. She had one foot tucked into a hold on the wall, her hand on another. She waited for the outrage or the vertigo or some physical sign in herself to match his expectations. What she found was a bleak disappointment. When he'd called her to his office, she'd suspected it was bad news. Now that the rest of the crew had been decanted and brought up to speed, anything said on the bridge, no matter how softly, was common knowledge in minutes. Fear did that to people, made them fast to share and gossip.
If I object to this plan, she said, because we both know I object to this plan,
I will pass it directly to High Consul Duarte, Segale said. It is as important to him as it is to me that you understand how seriously we take your concerns.
Will it change anything?
Candidly, Segale said.
For fuck's sake, another bomb ship after...
She gestured toward the deck with her free hand, meaning the ring space, the missing gates, all of it. She'd had almost 3 days to process the enormity of it, and she couldn't. It was too big. 3 days was long enough for Segale to report in and for Duarte to deliberate and respond. It probably wasn't long enough for Segale to have pushed back and been shut down. He hadn't even tried. That was the disappointing part.
We have protocol. It is that when a ship fails to transit, send a bomb ship through the same gate. It's the only way to keep our message clear.
And then see if we can lose another gate or two.
The losses that we have suffered are significant, Segale said. But it is the considered opinion of the High Council that they do not represent an escalation on the part of the enemy.
How do you even get there? Segale lifted a hand, palm out, but the softening in his eyes made it a request to hear him out more than an order that she be silent. Elvie crossed her arms and nodded him on.
The attacks the enemy made on us have been ineffective in that they did insignificant primary damage. The loss of consciousness that we experienced in Sol System when Pallas died might have been deadly for the protomolecule's designers, but it was largely ineffective against us. The response in Tacoma System would have been trivial in any other system. The effect was unfortunate only because of features of the landscape, so to speak, that are not in play elsewhere in the Empire.
So I just picked a bad Bikini Atoll, Elvie said.
No one holds you responsible for what happened, Doctor. You couldn't have known any more than we could. If anything, the strategic error was mine. I saw the inhospitable nature of the system as an advantage and overlooked the possible consequences.
He spread his hands. Or, Elvie said, it was a trap.
I don't see how...
No, be quiet. It's my turn now. What we saw in Tacoma wasn't even similar to the previous interactions. We were awake the whole time. It didn't change our perceptions of anything. That was something different. And if you look at the logic of it, it's not even hard to see.
Walk me through it.
That star wasn't natural. It was created. And it was created from a system that looked like Sol. It was manufactured, and it was pointed at the ring gate. They aimed it, like tying a shotgun trigger to a doorknob. Our bomb ship did something to activate it. Maybe it got something to come look at us. And that's what set it off. I don't know. But it was built to be a booby trap. Segale's scowl looked like he'd bitten into a bad date.
That is an interesting interpretation, he said.
It fired off the largest gun that it's possible to make, given the physical laws of the universe. And what's more, the station was built to withstand it. It took a gamma burst from a collapsing neutron star, and it's not dead.
You find that significant?
I find that pretty clear evidence that we're way out of our weight class here, and we should stop throwing punches.
You don't have to shout, Doctor.
Elvie unballed her fists and tried to relax her jaw.
Her blood felt hot in her face, and she didn't know if it was from fear or anger, or if any normal emotions actually fit into a situation like this. Segale's system chimed an alert, and he muted it.
I don't disagree with you, he said. But what does not throwing punches look like?
Not sending bomb ships through would be a start.
It would, but so would abandoning the gates entirely. Would you recommend doing that? There are colonies that will collapse if we choose that. And maybe those are acceptable losses. But once the trouble began last time, shutting down the gate network didn't save the beings that used it. They were dead when we turned the system back on.
Not starting trouble was my argument.
Trouble started long before Laconia existed. Ships have been disappearing for decades. Whatever this is, it began before we recognized it. The fastest way to undermine a strategic plan is to abandon it before there's sufficient reason to do so. The High Consul has been briefed. He believes that the tit-for-tat plan still has merit.
And so you're going to do it?
I do as I'm told, Doctor. I'm an officer of the Laconian military, Segale said. As are you.
The mood on the Falcon showed in small ways. Instead of wandering to and from the commissary while she thought, Jen remained rooted at her station. Trevon moved through the ship, tapping his thumb and middle finger together in a fluttering beat every time a new status update came from the Typhoon or Medina. Segale stayed in his office for the most part, avoiding Elvie and Faez and the rest of the science team as if their disapproval bothered him. Out near Medina, a captain drew a short straw, and the Myron's Folly was chosen as the bomb vessel. On the main screen, a swarm of loading mechs and drones hauled the cargo out of its hold. The little flares of their thrusters reminded Elvie of termite swarms. The antimatter had been stored on Medina for a moment just like this. Governor Song's engineers would set the ship's reactor as close to critical as they could and disable the failsafes, so that when the bombs went off, the reactor failure would add its own destructive punch to the mix. But there was the problem of making the ship go Dutchman in the absence of other traffic. The safety curve was based on the amount of matter and energy making transits through the gate network. Usually that meant keeping the flow down to safe levels. Now it meant driving it up past the threshold without sending another ship through. Protocol demanded, Segale kept pointing out, that the bomb ship be the next thing to go. If they started pushing a dozen other ships through, the enemy might not understand the High Consul's point. To do that, they had to pour a massive amount of energy through the gate. The Typhoon's ultra-high magnetic field projector could do it, but they were making sure there was nothing that would be damaged on the far side of the gate. The combination of caution and recklessness took her breath away. "I should go talk to him again," Elvi said.
"Tell him that he's wrong more forcefully," Faez said. "See if he changes his mind because you disagree at him harder."
"He's not that bad," she said. And then, because she knew that he was, "There has to be something."
"There doesn't, sweetheart."
Jen looked up from her station monitor. Her lips were thin, her gaze restless. 80,000 people in the Tanjavur system, she said. One habitable planet with three cities and a moon base on its major satellite. And there, I just can't get my head around it. They're just gone. They might be fine, Elvi said, just out of contact. They may be better off than all of us at this rate.
Unless their sun exploded.
There are stories about that, aren't there? The protomolecule engineers burning whole systems? Trevon fluttered his finger and thumb together again as he worked his station's monitor.
Tanjavur is only 8.5 years from Gadara. If there's a big flash in 8.5 years, we'll know what happened.
I don't like this, Jen said.
None of us do, Faez said. Honestly, I think old Segale would skip this part if he could.
What? Jen said. No, not that. I mean, yes, I don't like that, but this too. She threw a data set Elvi didn't recognize onto the main monitor. The Myron's Folly blinked away, and a series of energy graphs took its place. Jen turned to look at them as if the significance were obvious.
I'm a biologist, Elvi said.
We're seeing radiation coming from in between the rings. We've never seen that before. There hasn't been anything there to radiate. This little pocket universe just ends at the rings. Anything that went out was gone like it passed an event horizon. Now, since us, something's coming through.
Something's knocking around in the attic, Faya said.
That's not reassuring. I'm not reassured.
What do you make of it? Elvi asked.
I don't know. I just have data, and it says something's happening that didn't happen before, and it's not calming down. A voice in her memory said the words as clearly and distinctly as if they had been spoken. Distributed responsibility is the problem. One person gives the order, another carries it out. One can say they didn't pull the trigger, the other that they were just doing what they were told, and everyone lets themselves off the hook. She let her breath out slowly from between her teeth. Elvi opened a connection request to Segale's office. To his credit, he accepted it immediately.
Dr. Okoye.
Admiral, could you join us on the bridge? There's some incoming data I'd like you to look at. She heard the hesitation while he decided whether it was a ploy to stop the bombship plan. Just because the data was real didn't mean it wasn't a ploy.
I'm on my way, Segale said and cut the connection.
We could always mutiny, Faez said brightly.
We wouldn't stand a chance, Trevon said. I did the nav analysis. Even if we took control of the ship, the Typhoon could blow us to dust before we got out of gate.
Jesus, Trevon, Faez said. I was joking. Oh, Tavan said. Sorry. I remember when I was just a scientist, Elvis said. I liked that. It was nice. 5 minutes later, Segale came on the bridge, floating toward his station like none of them were there. Elvi remembered seeing him in the same place, still damp from the crash couch and weeping. He was a different man now. For a moment, against her will, she admired him. Segale considered the display in silence. The loudest sounds were the hush of the air recyclers and the flutter of Trevon's right thumb and middle finger. He considered the energy graphs as Jen explained them again. Segale took it in impassively. When Jen had finished, he floated quietly in his crash couch restraints. His gaze flickered to Elvie's, and she thought there was something in them. Gratitude, maybe. With a gesture, he opened a comm channel. Admiral Segale, Governor Song's voice came. How can I help you? It had a hint of Mariner Valley drawl. Elvi wondered if it was the mark of a Martian working for Laconia, or a Laconian who'd carried her accent out into the alien worlds and back again. Whether this obedience was peculiar to Duarte's people, or if it had been part of the Martian character all along. My eggheads came up with an analysis I'd like your eggheads to take a peek at, Governor. It may be nothing, but I'd recommend we hold action on the bomb ship until we know what we're looking at. There was a long pause. You have my curiosity, Admiral. Send over what you have. Thank you, Segale said, and the governor cut the connection. Share that with the Typhoon and Medina, Dr. Lively. Let's see if they share your concerns. Yes, sir, Jen said, and started packaging her information like she'd been given an extra 5 minutes on her final exams. Faez touched Elvie's shoulder and said, almost too softly to hear, Do you think we just got away with... The universe exploded. If it had been a sound, it would have been deafening. Elvi put her hands over her ears just the same, a reflex, an approximation. Jen was screaming. Elvi tried to sink to the deck, but only managed to pull her legs up so that she was floating in a fetal position. The curve of the handhold before her was ornate and beautiful. The smudge of darkness where the oil from the crew's skin hadn't been cleaned away was like a map of a vast coastline, fractal and complex. She was aware of fires beside her, of the waves of pressure passing between them, touching and reflecting away as they both screamed. The air was a fog of atoms. Segale was a cloud of atoms. She was a cloud. You've been here, she thought. You've been here before. Don't get distracted by it. Don't lose yourself. The cloud that was her hand, vibrations in emptiness, slipped through the void and clatter to the cloud that was the handhold. Fields of energy between her atoms and the bulkhead's atoms turned into a dance of pressure, and the surge sent lightning up her arm, so complicated it was hard to keep track of. She was aware that she felt it, but there was so much happening it was hard to keep the sensation in mind. Elvi found that she could see right through the suddenly vaporous ship and right through the other ship clouds around it. Medina was a vast but wispy thunderhead at the center of them all. Something was moving through the clouds, dark and sinuous as a dancer slipping between raindrops, and then another, and then more. They were everywhere. Sliding through the gas and liquid and solid, scattering the clouds with their passage. They were solid, real in a way the clouds of matter were not. They were more real than anything she'd ever seen. Tendrils of darkness that had never known light, that could never know light. You've seen this absence of light before. A darkness like the eye of an angry god. You said that to someone. One darted and swirled off to her left, if left meant anything now. It furled like a question mark, and the pattern of atoms and vibrations swirled around it and into it. The beauty of it, the grace, were hard to look away from. Clouds mixed and swirled together in its wake, colors so pure they were only colors. It took effort to recognize they were blood. She'd been here before. It had been overwhelming the first time. It was overwhelming again now, but at least she knew what it was. That made holding her mind together possible, at least for a moment.
"You're doing great, kid. You're doing great. You can do this. Just a little more, but do it now."
She tried to remember what her throat was, tried to imagine that the dots of matter and emptiness had said words before, that they still could. They were her body, the air she breathed. She tried to make it all work together long enough to scream.
"Emergency evacuation. Major Okoye, authorization Delta 8.
A tendril of darkness darted toward her and dropped away. All of them slid away, falling like black snowflakes through the cloud of vibrations that was the deck. Everything swirled, one form folding into another. If she unfocused her eyes, she could just recognize them. Jen's body, rolling as maneuvering thrusters made the deck into a hillside, someone's arm from fingers to elbow, and even a few centimeters of flesh beyond. The glow of the main display, too much itself to hold any meaning beyond the simple elegance of photons caught in air. She was aware of her own pain, like it was the sound of a distant waterfall. She fell through it, and into something like sleep. And a blink later, she was back. Thrust that could have been a third of a G or five Gs pulled her down. When she forced herself to sit up, blood glued her cheek to the deck. The air stank, but with too many different volatiles to make sense of. Alarms were sounding, echoing off each other in a meaningless cacophony. Everything had gone wrong at once. She hauled herself up to standing. The bridge was a thing from a nightmare. Swaths of bulkheads, decks, equipment were gone, like an artist had come in with an eraser and taken away bits of it at random. And the others, too. Segale was still at his post. A long loop of his head and right shoulder simply vanished. Jen lay in a still pile where the deck met the wall, covered in blood that might have been her own. Trevon's arm lay beside his station. But where his crash couch had been, there was a soft-edged hole down to the next deck, and the one below that. It was like seeing a coral reef made from her ship and her friends, and...
"Fayez!" she screamed. "Fayez!"
"Here," his voice said behind her. "I'm here. I'm okay."
He was in two-thirds of a crash couch. The fluid in the reservoir had all poured out and down and away.
"I'm okay," he said again.
"Your foot's gone," she said.
"I know, but I'm okay," he said, and closed his eyes.
Elvie stumbled to the console that looked most nearly intact. It was hard to walk, and she didn't know why until she looked down and saw that a scoop of her thigh the size of a softball was missing. As soon as she saw it, she felt the pain. A lesser ship would have been dead 100 times over, but the Falcon was hardy. Its skin had been cut 100 times, and it had regrown fast enough to keep in air. The reactor was throwing errors and emergency corrections. The log spooling so fast she couldn't keep track. She pulled up the sensor arrays, and stars appeared on her screen. The ship was out of the slow zone, free of the rings. The system identified Laconia's sky. She turned the ship's attention back to the ring gate falling away behind them. It looked calm, as if nothing at all odd had just happened. She felt laughter burbling up in her throat, and tried to keep it down, uncertain whether it would stop once it got started. She opened a broadcast channel and prayed that enough of the Falcon still existed to get the signal out. For a moment, the system didn't respond, and her heart sank. Then, the transmitter hauled itself to life.
"Thank you," she told the ship. "Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you."
She gathered her strength, wondering how much blood she'd lost, how much she had left. "To any ship in range, this is Major Elvi Okoye of the Laconian Science Directorate. I am in need of immediate aid. We have mass casualties."
Chapter 22. Teresa.
"I've never seen anyone that angry before," she said. She was telling the story of little Monster Singh and her mother. "I mean, I've probably been mad, but this was different. This girl was..."
"Seriously? You're one of the angriest people I know, Tiny," Timothy said. His food recycler was in pieces, laid out on a blanket, everything carefully in place, like an exploded drawing of itself. Only the built-in power supply was still inside the frame. Timothy was going through the components now, cleaning and polishing each one, looking for the signs of wear. Teresa sat on his cot with her back against the cave wall, her legs pulled up in front of her and Muskrat snoring contentedly at her side. A repair drone lurked at the edge of the light, its bulbous black eyes looking vaguely hurt that Timothy wasn't letting it take care of the equipment. "I'm not an angry person," she said. Then a moment later, "I don't think I'm angry." Timothy tossed her a pair of dark goggles and motioned for her to put them on. She did, and put a hand over Muskrat's eyes so that she wouldn't be blinded. After a few seconds, the light of a welding torch burst in her vision like a tiny green star. The smoke was acrid and metallic, and she liked it. "Thing is," Timothy said, loud over the roar of the torch, "there's only a couple kinds of anger. You get angry because you're afraid of something, or you get angry because you're frustrated."
The torch turned off with a pop.
"Safe?" Teresa asked.
"Sure, you can take them off."
When she did, the cave seemed brighter than when she'd put them on before. Even with the intensity of the light, her eyes had adapted to darkness. She scratched Muskrat's ears as Timothy went on.
"If you're, I don't know, if you're scared maybe your dad isn't the kind of guy you thought he was, you might get angry. Or you're afraid no one's got your back, like Nutless."
"His name's Connor," Teresa said, but she smiled when she said it.
"Yeah, him," Timothy agreed. "Or maybe you're afraid he made you look stupid in front of your crew, so you get angry. If you didn't give a shit whether your old man lived or died, if Nutless and your crew didn't matter to you, then you're not angry. Or the other way, you're trying to get something to work, a conduit to fit. Been working at it for hours, and just when it's looking about right, the metal bends on you and you gotta start over. That's angry too. But it ain't scared angry. It's the other one."
"So, you look at me," Teresa said, derision in her voice, "and you think I'm scared and frustrated?"
"Yep."
Teresa's mockery died, and she hugged her knees. It didn't fit at all with who and what she thought she was. But something in her leaped toward his word. It felt like recognizing someone. Like catching a glimpse of herself from an angle she'd never seen before. It was fascinating. "How do you deal with it?"
"Fucked if I know, Tiny. I don't do those."
"You don't get angry?"
"Not out of fear, anyway. I don't remember the last time I was afraid of something. Frustration was more my thing. But I had this friend, and I watched her die slow. I couldn't do anything about it. That was frustrating, and I got angry. Started looking for a fight. But I had another friend who straightened me out."
"How?"
"She beat the living shit out of me," Timothy said. "That helped. And ever since then, Nothing has seemed like it was worth getting too bent out of shape over.
He rolled a bright silver cone about the size of a thumb in his palm and scowled.
What is it? She asked.
Injector's getting a little ragged at the mouth is all, Timothy said. I can touch it up. Just means I'll be drinking my yeast patties more than eating them.
You spend a lot of time with that thing.
You take care of your tools take care of you.
Teresa leaned against the wall. The stone was cool against her back. Deep cave temperatures were the measure of the underlying climate average. Mass and depth smoothed out the daily highs and lows, even the annual fluctuations of summer and winter. She knew it intellectually, but she hadn't understood it until Timothy's cave. The way it always felt cool in the heat and warm in the chill.
You know, the wise man living alone on the mountain is really cliché, she said, smiling when she said it so he wouldn't think she was being mean. Anyway, I don't have anything to be scared of.
Assassins with pocket nukes, for one, Timothy said, slotting the injector back into its housing.
Teresa laughed, and after a second, Timothy smiled too. If anyone's going to kill me, it'll probably be Dr. Cortázar, she said.
Yeah, why's that?
It's just a joke. I was watching Holden, like we talked about, and I heard this conversation he and Dr. Cortázar were having.
What about? Timothy asked idly.
Teresa thought back. What had they been talking about exactly? Mostly she remembered Cortázar talking about how nature ate babies, and Holden looking into the camera. But it had been about her father, too. She took in a breath, ready to speak, and the air rattled against the back of her throat and down into her lungs like a billion little molecule-sized marbles banging against the soft tissue. Her respiration system was a cave inside Timothy's cave, and she was acutely aware of the complexity of her own body and the answering complexity of the caverns around her. Veins and chips in the wall before her fragmented and smoothed together. Gravity trying to tug her down into the floor, and the astonishingly complex dance of the electrons in the stone and her flesh pushing back. She managed to wonder if she'd been drugged, before her awareness was overwhelmed by the immediacy and complexity of the air and her body and the increasingly invisible boundary that failed to really divide her from the world. Muskrat barked anxiously. She slumped down on the cot at some point without knowing she was doing it. Timothy stood up, his expression perfectly focused and his recycler forgotten. The repair drone made a weird yipping sound as it tried to stand up, staggering drunkenly.
That wasn't just me, right? Timothy said.
I don't think so, Teresa said.
Yeah, all right, it's been fun, Tiny, but you need to head home now.
What was that? Is there something wrong with the air in here? Are there fumes?
Nope, Timothy said, taking her by the arm and lifting her to her feet. Air's fine. That was something else. And it probably happened to a lot of people, so they're going to be scared, and they're going to want to find where everyone important to them is, and that's you. So you need to be not here.
I don't understand, she said. But Timothy was pulling her forward, toward the mouth of the cave. His grip on her arm was like a vice. His expression was blank. It made him frightening.
Muskrat followed behind, barking like she was trying to warn them of something. In the open air, the world was normal. The strange sensation she'd had before already seemed like a bad dream or an accident. Timothy's reaction was the only thing that made it frightening. He looked up, scanning the sky, then nodded to himself.
Okay, Tiny, you and the furball head back home.
I'll come back as soon as I can, she said. She didn't know why she wanted to reassure him.
Okay.
It was the way he said it, like his mind was already someplace else. She'd had adults treat her like that before, polite and agreeable, but elsewhere. Never Timothy, though. He was different. He was supposed to be different. Will you be here when I do?
I'll have to, I guess. I'm not done yet, so...
She hugged him. It was like hugging a tree. He pulled back, and when he looked at her, she thought there was something like regret in his expression. It couldn't have been pity.
Good luck, Tiny, he said,
then turned back toward his cave and was gone. Muskrat barked once and looked after him, as worried as Teresa was. Come on, she said, and started for her secret passage back into the state building and home. The afternoon was cool. The leaves were starting to retreat back into their winter sheaths, leaving the trees looking stubbly. A sunbird hanging on a low branch opened its leathery wings at her and hissed, but she ignored it. At the horizon, wide clouds bunched and trailed gray veils of storm. If they came this way, the drainage tunnel would be impassable, and she'd be stuck outside the walls. She picked up her pace. The sound of the flyer started as a high and distant whine, but it grew louder quickly. Less than a minute after she first noticed it, the sound was a roar. The black laminate body and three cold thrusters appeared over the treetops and fell into a thin meadow, hardly more than a break between trees. When the door popped open, she expected to see the light blue uniforms of security. She prepared to identify herself and explain that she'd decided to go for a hike. It was only partly a lie. But while there were two armed guards, the first person out of the flyer was Colonel Illich. He trotted toward her, and his face was dark. The thrusters didn't cycle all the way down, so when he reached her, he had to shout,
Get in the flyer!
What?
You need to get in the flyer now! You have to get back to the state building.
I don't understand. Illich's jaw clenched, and he pointed at the open door.
You, there, now. This isn't difficult.
Teresa stepped back like she'd been slapped. In all the years Illich had been her tutor, he had never been mean to her. Never been anything but patient and supportive and amused. Even when she didn't do her work or did something inappropriate, the punishment was just a long talk about why she'd made the choices she did and what the goals of her education were. It was like seeing a different man in an Illich suit. She felt tears welling up in her eyes. She saw, oh, for fuck's sake, on his lips, but she couldn't hear it. He made a little bow and gestured her forward like a servant making way for his master, but she felt the impatience in it, the contempt, the anger. Oh, she thought as she walked to the flyer, he's frightened. At the flyer, Muskrat balked, and before Teresa could coax her in, Illich assigned one of the guards to go back on foot with the dog. The flyer's door closed with a deep clank, and they lurched up over the trees. Even though the body of the flyer had looked opaque from the outside, it was no darker than tinted glass from her seat. She could see the state building clearly as soon as they cleared the top branches. How did you know where I was? Teresa asked. Illich shook his head, and for a moment she thought he wasn't going to answer. When he did, his voice had more like its usual tone, patient and gentle. The difference was that now she knew it was a mask.
You had a locator implanted in your jawbone when you were born. There is never a moment when security doesn't know how to find you, and your safety is part of my sacred duty.
It was like hearing a language she almost understood. She could pick out the meaning of each word, but she couldn't quite make sense of the whole. The idea was too foreign, too wrong.
Your father felt it was important for you to have some experience of rebellion and autonomy. So he permitted your excursion, so long as they didn't take you too far from the state building. He said he was solo free climbing on the surface of Mars at your age, and that he learned things about himself that way. He hoped you would find use in the same independence and solitude.
Solitude? He didn't know about Timothy then. There was nothing on any world that would make her tell him either.